Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At the time, you run the TechNet, as we do most Sunday evenings for the last 35 or so years, let's say 1982, 36 years it's going on. This will be TechNet number 1693, 94. We also have a section of the net run by Roy, AC2GS, which is called the Science and Physics Report. And we have another section run by Paul, WS2N, which is the Space Report. And we got lots of subjects to discuss tonight. Quite possibly Roy's going to be talking about sublimation. I might do a little bit of talk about the puzzle I gave you guys a hint of last week. Why does the bottom of your bicycle pump get hot? Very simple sounding question. You'd be amazed what the answer is. And when it comes to the space report, I possibly we're going to hear about the new Goddard space flight development, where they're developing a robot that can go out there and do repairs and rescue satellites and so on. So we've been speculating about that for some time. Looks like Goddard is really working on such a project. Can we drop? As you guys have heard me say so often, the main purpose of the TechNet is education. The curious radio amateurs, the guys who have a little bit of curiosity about how does wireless equipment really work? How does that radio wave really go through the vacuum of space? That's kind of magic. And as I said quite often, there's a scientist built into each real radio amateur, in my opinion, trying to get out. So that's the reason why we discuss subjects like this. So the curious people come together and educate each other. No guarantee that everything you're going to hear is perfectly accurate, but there was a kind of a peer review going on. Mike number one, KC2NJI, has a website where all of the TechNets get recorded for the last 12 years. And that's at amateurradio.tangovictor. At amateurradio.tangovictor, you can find the last 12 years. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and play it back. And so for the people who can't stay up late, this net, because there's a darn much enthusiasm over the last 35 years, and now for the last 20 or so years, it lasts for 4 hours. Some people can't stay up that late. They fall asleep. And so by way of the recordings, you can download it to your portable device, whatever that is, and play it back at some other time while you're commuting, while you're on your lunch break, and so on. There are electrical engineering professors in the local states who occasionally will recommend that their electrical engineering students listen to the TechNet to find out what the real world of wireless radio is really like, which is it's quite a bit different than the way it's taught in the schools. And that's a statement of mine that I said quite often, that radio is not taught in a useful engineering manner, in my opinion. It can be done a lot better using a tradition that started way back.
Repeater, time out.
They're using a traditional technique that started way back in 1948. Okay. You should also know that there's a second website that supports the TechNet run by Mike number two, K1MJM. That's LimarkTechNet.com, which has supporting information and graphs and diagrams and photographs and so on. A person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or a comment by giving us his call letters, his name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Let me drop. You need that sign-in just because you're listening. After 35, 36 years, we believe somebody is listening. It doesn't have to be proven anymore, so we can save time by not taking those kind of check-ins. Do try to remember in between each one of your transmissions to leave enough of a pause so that there is 4 beeps, so you don't time out the machine like I just did a little while ago. And do give me your name, because I like referring to people by name, and I'm very forgetful. So, for these people who do have a question or a comment for the net, give me a call letters and name right now, wait for the beeps, and give me that call letters and name, KQLIW.
KD2NVB, Bob, yes.
KD2AJ,
Eric, yes.
WH4RY, go, yes.
KD2NVB, Bob, yes.
AC2LR
with an announcement that needs to be told as early as possible.
Okay, AC2LR, go right ahead.
So tonight at 8:45 p.m., the International Space Station is going to appear to slowly climb in the sky over the northeast, and we're going to have a pretty good chance to see it. If you look in the northeast at 8:45, you'll see it rise to its highest point around 8:47. It's going to be in the north-northeast at that point, and possibly even directly overhead. It's going to appear to pass across the stars of the Big Dipper. And anyway, it should be one of the brightest visuals we're going to get. And it's going to last pretty long, too. So if you want to step outside at 8:45 p.m., please take a look.
Does anybody need to fill in that information? Give me a call at us right now. Okay, of the people who signed in, I heard Bob, I think it's Mike, David, Bravo. Did I have your call letters correct, Bob? Bob, and please give me your prefix.
It's November Victor Bravo, unless it was another Bob. I think I'm the only Bob. It was Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo.
Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo. Got you, Bob. Then it was KE2EJ. Then Joe, W82RYY, and then KD2ONVB. Did you sign in twice, or was there another? The first was Bob who signed in. What was your call letters?
This is Bob, KD2NVB. I signed in twice because I thought I didn't get through the first time, but I guess I was wrong.
All's well, Bob. Okay. Got you in twice is good. All right, and Eric? And Joe? All right, so we got Bob, Eric, and Joe. Anyone else deciding? Give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps.
KC1, Sierra Alpha Mike. Sam, yes.
Okay, we got KC1, Sierra Alpha Mike. Anyone else? We have more than enough to get started. So, November Victor Bravo, Bob. You got it. We're all listening. What question or comment would you like to make? Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, Jake. Hi, everybody on the net. Yes, it's probably going to be short. It's just mainly a comment. I came on before. I was buying a new radio, and I was worried that I'd connect to this repeater. Well, it seems like I'm connecting pretty well, so I'm very happy about that. I basically wanted to report that. I have my quarter wave inside my apartment. I have a quarter wave mag mount on a metal cabinet between two windows. I moved it from the refrigerator that's on the other side of the room to the. So it's working pretty well. I did a couple tests this week, got good reports. I assume it's good right now and very happy. And to stay there, I'm going to have to extend this wire a little bit. I'm going to have to put a double female. Adapter extended. I'm afraid I'll get some more loss, but other than that, I'll find out. So that's probably about it for me right now. So this is KD2NDD. Back to you.
Yes, that antenna and location is working rather well, Bob. I do remember making suggestions to you to try the mag mount on the side, the top, the right, left side, and so on. Don't worry about the fact that the antenna might be horizontally positioned, because by the time the signal finishes bouncing off of all of the things in your environment and finally gets out to the repeater, the polarization can become just about anything. When it comes to adding an extension cable, the insertion loss of the cable is the only loss you have to worry about. Everyone thinks that every adapter and every connector has loss. Absolutely not. As long as it's really making contact, you can confirm with an ohmmeter. The only thing that creates loss at radio frequencies is something that has length. Your connector has a length of a half an inch. If you had to make a half a dB of loss in a half inch, you'd be amazed how difficult that would be to do. The connector cannot do that. The adapter cannot do that. Even stacking adapters together does not create loss. If it was a really poorly made adapter with the wrong inside and outside diameter, it might create a little bit of standing wave ratio. But even that is not lost in the I squared R manner. So choose the right cable where the cable itself has enough low loss in dB per 100 feet, and your extension cable will be very convenient, and it'll be a zipper right at the end of the cable on the on the antenna with no real adapter. Let me drop. There's a zillion people out there who believe each UHF connector and each BNC connector creates half a dB of loss. Absolutely not. You can prove that real fast, because if it had half a dB of loss and you put 10 watts of power through it, you would feel the heat. You'd feel how hot the connector is getting in its loss mechanism. They run ice cold. So I think you are also going to be experimenting, if I remember, Bob, with other kinds of antennas inside your apartment. Is that true? KD2NVB. KD2NVB. K2IW. You got Bob.
Yes, Dick, I'm going to be... This is just, 2 meters, of course, that I got now. This radio, it's a ICOP 7100, so it's an all-band radio, that's so-called. It does 2 meters, 440, and HF, so I'm going to try to get on HF for the first time. But, like I said before, I think I'm going to be indoors, although I've talked to some people about possibly stringing a wire across the public sidewalk in front of my window to a tree. I'm a little nervous about that. I'm just trying not to draw any attention, but it's a possibility I might try that. But I think I'm putting a loop in. Maybe I have a quick question. There was a loop I saw that is only 45 watts max, but the advantage is it's portable. I could also take it into the park or something. And there's another loop I was looking at that could do by 400 watts, which I could do on this radio. But it's heavy, and I wouldn't be able to do that. So I'm guessing here what how significant that difference is. That's only if I get it. I'm still going to, the jury's out on this. I'm thinking about it. Maybe a while before I get an HF antenna. I'm doing a lot of thinking and research. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we've had some minor discussions on loop antennas over the last two technets. It is an antenna type that is very unpopular. I think only a couple of percent of the amateurs have ever used a loop antenna. The belief is that since the loop antenna is so small, for instance, an 80-meter loop commercially made might be 3 or 4 feet in diameter, whereas a real 80-meter half-wave dipole is 132 feet long. Everyone believes that a small antenna must have low efficiency, low gain, low effective capture area. Good common sense, dead wrong. If at the exact same altitude you mounted a loop antenna that's 4 feet in diameter, made out of good low-loss materials, and you compare that to the performance of a 132-foot half-wave dipole made out of 14 or 12-gauge wire, you'd get the exact same gain. The half-wave dipole would have more bandwidth. You'd be able to QSY further without retuning. So the slight disadvantage of the small, physical-sized antenna is that it's higher in Q, more narrowband. You QSY 50KC, you got to do some retuning. And a loop that's only rated, let me drop it. If it's only rated for 40 watts, it isn't because something's going to get hot. If they've made use of good low-loss materials, the antenna could run ice cold with 40 watts into it. The only reason why the 40 watts might be a limitation is because a small loop antenna usually is tuned with an air variable capacitor, quite often air variable capacitor, at the far end of where it's being fed. And you develop a pretty high voltage, because the antenna's got a high Q, you develop a pretty high voltage across that capacitor, and you might arc it over. If you're willing to change that capacitor to one with greater spacing between the plates, or greater plate area, so you can get the same number of picofarads with a greater spacing, because the area of the plates is made larger. Or if you do anything to create the arc over voltage, the breakdown voltage, you could put more watts into it. So a loop antenna that you could put hundreds of watts into it is not violating any of the laws of physics. Don't mount your head real close to the loop, because it's putting out some pretty strong local fields. Be at least 5 feet away from it, so to speak. But transmitting into a loop is very possible if you're using the right materials. And so in a small apartment where you don't have a whole lot of area, loop antennas, which are easy to aim, easy to build, easy to manipulate, and so on, it's definitely an antenna to try. And ignore the fact that, let me drop. Ignore the fact that all your buddies in 20 meters will give you their theory that because it's only a few feet in diameter, about as opposed to 132 feet long, that it's going to have lower gain or lower performance. The guy who wrote one of the best, most respected books on antennas is John Krause, W-H-A-K, who had a prominent position in the electrical engineering department of Ohio, the University of Ohio, Ohio University, anyhow. In Ohio, he's a college professor, and he wrote a book that's used for senior year antenna design, or electronic design. The book is called Antennas, 1950 McGraw-Hill. In there, you read the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole. You can take that 132-foot dipole in 80 meters and build a version of it that's 30 feet long instead of 132 feet long. And with the right kind of a tuning assembly connected to it, you'll get the exact same performance at detuned frequency as the full-size dipole. Obviously, it's opposite of common sense, but there's a whole lot of complicated reasons as to why that's true. So don't worry about the fact that you're using small antennas. Just be willing to retune them every time you QSY 50KC. Back to you for any final comments, Bob. KD2, November, Victor Bravo. Soon to be miniature antenna expert within a province. You got it, Bob. K2LIW.
Thanks, Dick. I hope I didn't come in too early. I don't want to take up too much more time, but my big concern right now about trying, well, the loop or any indoor antenna, I'm just going to have to do it and see what happens. I realize I'm in an old building, and I've talked to Roy about this AT2GS, and yeah, he said something that make a lot of sense to me, that my walls probably are full of chicken wire. That's what they used to do to build walls.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, sorry that we didn't leave enough time and you timed it out, Bob. But I'm going to go on to the next person now. Eric, KE2EJ. I gave you a quick little memo very late about what's going on with the ATS. What is it now? Advanced Television Selection Committee? Advanced Television's, I think it's Selection Committee. 3.0 antenna standard that we're about to start receiving 4K high definition, ultra high definition television with. So, any of those subjects you'd like to talk about, Eric, or any questions, you've got it. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. All right, well, by the way, how well do you copy me?
You sound beautiful. Plenty of audio, plenty of RF. Please continue. Wait for the beeps.
All right, I'm running low power into a remote receiver that's sitting behind me. I have an issue. It's just a question for you. Let me kind of lay it out. I've got a low power FM station. It's on top of a very tall building, and it's on a frequency which actually is has a special license, simply because it doesn't meet the boundaries of how far a station has to be apart to be on the same co-channel. Okay, given that, I'm on this building, my ERP is 10 watts. Okay, I'm using an antenna which is centrally polarized, alright? It's both A and B. It kind of looks like a halo, and it's omnidirectional. In theory, I'm mounted on a tower, okay, that the coverage area is, as far as the FCC is concerned, is a circle. And then many, many, many miles to the west, there's this other station which has the variance in terms of closeness to other stations. And what I really want to do, all right, let me go a little further. I'm going to drop. It's mounted within this tower is actually, it has three levels, and the antenna is mounted set back in the tower a little bit, all right? We got unbelievable coverage to the west. Now, don't forget, it's 10 watts VIP. It's free power. And it actually intrudes on this station, which is about 40 miles away. I mean, I haven't measured what the actual signal strength is out there, but it puts out a whopper of a signal for free power. Going south, now this is in New York City. Now, let me tell you what building it's on. It's on 4 Times Square. Heading downtown, reception is pretty lousy because of all the multipaths and all the buildings in the way. So the east, it's a similar story, and I think some of it is because of the way it's mounted in the tower. It's mounted on the west side of the tower. What I want to do is put it on the east side of the tower to try and null out a little bit of the west-going energy. I was going to ask you if, let's say this was at the top of the tower, how would you put a null in this particular antenna situation? The antenna is the antenna. It actually makes some nulls because of where it's mounted in the tower. I'm going to move it. Actually, I want to cover Brooklyn and Queens better than I am New Jersey because the mother station actually covers New Jersey. There's no reason to duplicate the coverage there. What would you suggest? K2RIW, K2JAM.
On a quick break, Eric, what's the approximate cross-sectional area of the tower where the antenna is mounted sort of in the tower? So it's in the tower. Is the tower a triangular thing with 3 feet on the face, so to speak? Eric, go ahead.
No, actually, the tower is pretty big. It's maybe 50 feet by 50 feet by 50 feet by 50 feet. And there's actually 3 levels that you can walk up to, and then there's more stuff even higher. So, yeah, it's kind of set into the tower by maybe 10 feet.
Wow, wow, I'm getting the picture. It sounds like where the antenna is mounted could be a habitable area if it wasn't for where the antennas and electronics and whatever are mounted. And so what pattern you get out of that steel structure, and I'm guessing there's steel in that, is going to be disturbing the daylights out of the pattern, so it's going to have peaks and valleys all over the place. And if you're willing to fly a drone field strength meter at various altitudes and do an azimuth scan around the building, that's one way you could find out what the pattern is really like. Recording that would be an interesting bit of science. But now, to intentionally create a null in a particular direction, a single null, a cordioid antenna pattern would do that. And how do you make a cordioid antenna pattern? Mount a pair of antennas at the exact same altitude, exact same kind of antenna, approximately a half wavelength apart, and feed them with a signal that is a half wave out of phase. So that you're literally creating a two-element Yagi, so to speak, but half wave spacing, half wave of difference. In one direction, the signals will add, in the other direction, the signals will cancel because of the rate at which the signal propagates through the air and a half wavelength of spacing. That would create a very deep null in the direction that you want to create the null, and you can change the depth of the null by the amount of power you feed to the second antenna. As you start lowering that power, the null depth will start going lower and lower. So that's one approach. There's a zillion approaches on making a null, but directional antennas, a real space in between antennas fed equal power, can give you some real interferometry null in one direction and interferometry peaking in the other direction simultaneously. I wonder if you got that picture, Eric.
Repeater, timeout.
Great timing. You've got it, Eric. K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, that was my first thought, but the problem in doing that in terms of physically mounting. I may, in the end, actually have to go to directional antenna to do what I want to do. I'm trying to avoid doing, although I want to maybe take advantage of the tower structure itself, although flying a drone around it is an interesting concept, except that that's going to take a bit of doing and some special clearances from the city of New York. That's going to be the least possible thing to do. what I'm probably going to do is attempt to do the same thing with the antenna on the other side, and actually a little more towards the south and the east, so it doesn't get that exposure to the west. And hopefully, I can get that flowered pattern going the right way, which is just going to be a big guess. It's kind of hard to figure out mathematically because of all the stuff that's there. There's a certain amount of interaction between the tower, the other poles that are there that are holding various other antennas. And you got to remember, it's a we beg for money station, so money is not flowing, so to speak. Although I still question the area covered because the owner of the station is kind of being cautious. And the fact that they can hear it that far out bothers them. But, that's something. FM being the way it is, there comes a point where capture takes over, and they have yet to tell me where that occurs, so then I can really decide.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, if you're using the building itself as a partial reflecting device, and the things that are going to give you the significant reflection are very, very different than what your eye sees. An awful lot of those poles, if they're not resonant in their length or their diameter, are amazingly transparent to your FM wave. And I'm just aware of that. Okay, so an awful lot of things that you think are opaque are really transparent. Lots of people, you know, you use your eye and something that's extremely solid, you'd be amazed how much the RF energy would just wrap around it and keep right on going. Even the far side of a water tower, in some cases, can give you an awful lot of signal where you think there should be a complete null. And often there's even a little bit of gain out there. RF is funny stuff, the skin effect and whatever. But where the objects that are reflective on that floor of that building are multiple wavelengths apart, then this great nulling characteristic becomes very complicated. By the way, when it comes to flying the drone to give you an antenna pattern, there are commercial services out there that you can hire where they've already solved the problem, they've already got the permits. In fact, let me drop it. The Friendly Candy Company wanted everybody to register their drones, or was it the FAA, wanted everybody to register their drones, and that got challenged. As long as the drone is below a certain number of pounds of weight, you don't have to register them anymore. So a well-designed drone can be very small, under the weight requirement, where no registering, no licensing, and so on. So you can hire a service that can do that for you, that's already got the permit, so to speak. And that would very much simplify the whole situation. And once you look at that pattern, flying the drone, let me pick a number, you know, half a mile away from the building, and you fly 360 degrees a circle around it. And as long as you've got a good recording technique, that's going to give you a lot of information as to what the building is really doing. It'll give you some hints as to what you're able to gather, what you're able to gain by mounting the antenna in another location. And the outside terrain may be more of an influence than the building itself. You'd like to believe that putting the antenna on the east side of the building is going to have it favor stations to the east and non-favor stations to the west. Good guess. Once in a while, the truth is stranger than fiction. Over to you. I know I haven't given you an answer, but at least you and I are discussing some of the variables involved. KE2EJ, K2IW in the TechNet.
It's RIW, KE2EJ. Actually, I should price out what a service like that would cost. That would give us a pretty definitive answer quite quickly. I mean, it irks me because New Jersey is very mountainous. There's these hills that have to go over to reach where we're headed. Actually, the station that we're concerned about is in Hackettstown, New Jersey, which is getting close to the Pennsylvania side. And the fact that we're putting out so little signal, it's unbelievable. Don't forget, we're like 800 feet in the air. I don't know what the height of that building is. And it's on the top. Let's put it this way. If you watch channel 25, that antenna is a few feet above where the antenna I'm talking about is.
And out in Huntington, where I live, channel 25 is gangbusters these days, with a rather simple television aerial on the roof of the house, looking into a mile of trees that are 60 feet higher than my antenna. So, that signal is doing very well. What's the approximate effective radiated power of channel 25, Eric? Go ahead.
No, I know the transmitter is just 2.5 kilowatts. I don't know what the gain of the antenna is. I can look it up. It'll take a minute.
Since you know what frequency you're on, you know the size of the antenna, we could easily ballpark the gain of the antenna. But you've got the real data. So, yeah, I think you want to find out what it costs. And there's multiple services out there that will measure that antenna pattern for you with drones. These drones these days are really being used a lot. For instance, if you were a person that's crazy enough to really care about the Burning Man celebration, and I think this is the 16th or the 17th year, held in Black Rock, Nevada, 70,000 people gather for about a week and a half at this crazy event. And you go to YouTube and ask for Burning Man event, and you start looking at those videos. They got for the last 4 years or so. Let me drop it. For the last 4 years, various people are flying drones with recording video cameras on them to allow you to see what this event of 70,000 people looks to me like. It fills up 500 acres with all kinds of temporarily structures and whatever. A bunch of crazy people get together and have this event. So that'll give you a hint as to what drones can do. Or if you take a look at some other YouTube videos that are done by this Veritasium group. I can't think of the guy's name right now. He's got these beautiful educational things where he flies his drone around various things that he's giving you information about. So drones are here to stay, and they're being used an awful lot. Back to you for any further information, Eric. And by the way, I think I've told you that the March issue of Microwaves and RF has a beautiful article about the 3.0 ATSC, the new high-definition digital television system that's becoming active right now. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Derek Mueller.
That's the name, Derek Mueller. He's got some beautiful educational videos. He's got hundreds of these things. The one that's extremely well done tells you about the nuclear radiation effect you get from cigarette smoke, a very surprising event. So do ask for Derek Mueller when you go to YouTube video and start looking at some of those. They're very well done. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, let's see. The height above average today is 309 meters. The height above sea level is 324 meters. And channel 25 VIP is 151 kilowatts. VIP.
2.5 kilowatts of real radiated power and 151 kilowatts of effective radiated power. If I divide 2.5 into 151, boy, they're getting a lot of gain out of that antenna. But UHF can do that. So that antenna must be a fairly tall, round pole, I think. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, it is. And it's made out of individual panels. I don't know how many there are. But I think on the World Trade, we're waiting for them to finish the wiring up the VHF panels, and I think that is like 63 or 64 of them. So that's how they get the gain. But anyway, that's the height that we're talking about.
So your 10 watt FM low power station, oh, amazing. If you and I calculated the sensitivity of a handheld FM radio, and 2.5 watts, although you're getting some gain out of that antenna. What's your guess as to the gain? 10 watts of radius. Oh, no, you did say 10 watts of ERP. Yes, 10 watts of ERP.
That gives you a calculated range free space of what, 10 miles or something like that, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's almost 20 miles. Not quite that much. And the interesting thing is, if you actually go to the antenna manufacturer's site, they will list that single bay as minus 3 dB in terms of gain.
So, if the antenna has minus 3 dB of gain and 10 watts of ERP, does that mean you're really putting 20 watts into it? And it sounds like it's got to be solid state. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, the transmitter puts out 27 watts to account for the losses of the cable.
That station has been on the air in that state for how long now, Eric? Has it been operating this way for a couple of years?
No, actually, about 6 months ago, it had a couple of directional antennas, and it was synchronous with the station. And the fact that it was synchronous, I guess it was pretty well, but there are a lot of areas where it would bang against the main station. And, you know, you just can't draw a straight line and say, this is the point where coverage from station A ends and coverage from station B ends, or begins. And it works out pretty well that being in the densely populated neighborhood of New York, you know, a lot of places where it doesn't work out well at all.
It might be kind of fun for me to go try to listen to that station. Can you tell me its call letters and its frequency? If you're able to, it's your choice, Eric. Go ahead.
All right, you won't hear it. You'll hear the main station in Riverhead, which is a different station. It's on, the station we're talking about is on 91.9. The main station is at 91.1. They're in East Orange on the hill, on the mountain. And the 91.9 is on top of Fort Times Square. There's also another 91.9, which is also the same station, same audio, in Rockland County, on top of a mountain there, but that's a whole different story. And then we have another station in Mount Hope, New York, which is on 90.7, which covers a huge area of upstate New York and New Jersey. So that's the whole picture.
Okay, so the 91.9 that we're now talking about, 10 watts of ERP, what's the call letters of that station, Eric? And are you the chief engineer for that one also?
Yeah, it's WFMU. The other full power station is WMFU. That's the one in Mount Hope. And actually, the call sign for the repeaters are, what is it, W220, which is the FM channel. You know, FM is channelized. FM220, I think, Charlie Edwards.
Okay, interesting information. So you're saying if I tried listening to 91.9 with a directional antenna aimed at Fort Times Square, I would most likely pick up the back lobes of Riverhead. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the station in Riverhead's fairly strong. I start losing it around, I guess, Westbury. I start picking up the Fort Times Square station just before I hit the Cross Island. And by the way, since the station, that frequency was vacant for so long, there are these pirates that keep popping up all the time.
In the old days, the FCC was very good at finding pirates. Are they equally as effective these days, or are the pirates so darn mobile and so darn crafty that they're getting away with it? What's the approximate status of that one, Eric?
Actually, the FCC has gotten very active in finding pirates lately. And they've been finding them left and right. If you go to the enforcement pages of the FCC, they don't update it that often, but it's getting more and more full. Actually, if you go on the web and type in 91.9, you'll find this Brazilian or Puerto Rican station that's online, but They were fined, I think, a couple years ago, like $20,000, and they're told to get off the yard. And then they came back on again. They come on with like kilowatts, so it just wipes everything else out. From your point of view, what is the major motivation of a pirate station? Is it because are people who are very foreign language influential, they fear that their foreign language is not being properly covered? Or is it people who want their style of music and they think that their kind of music is not being covered? I'm having a hard job believing that a pirate radio station is doing it for economic gain. I don't think they're getting rich quick. So I think they want their language or their nationality favored, maybe their religion favored, and their music favored. Those are guesses on my part. KE2EJ, K2IW.
I have some interesting comments here.
Well, the big pirates, they're interested in one thing, and that's advertising dollars. They play music of their style from their country, and they keep moving them around, you know. They get caught, they pay the fine, they change locations. Actually, one of them had like 6 different transmitting locations, and they would switch between them all the time. I think that was George who said he got some additional information. Go right ahead with your additional information.
This is John, KC2SHO in Los Alamos. Well, I could probably make a few comments here. I'll try to keep it short. One might be worth taking a look at the Prometheus project. It's been a while. I can't give you a synopsis of that right now, but that's an interesting one for the low power stations. There's a ham radio operator by the name of Bernie, and I've never really talked to him on the air. I've always talked to him in person. He's in Philadelphia, and he actually went around and interviewed a bunch of these pirate radio stations to kind of see what their motivation was and what they were trying to get out of this and stuff like that, and I think also maybe to give them some information about applying for a low power license. I could get you that call sign if you want. I just got to get back to my computer or something like that where I can actually look up his information. Because, again, I've never actually talked to him on air. But the results of his interview might be very interesting if people want to know more in line of this conversation. K2RIW, KC2SHO. I hope I'm loud enough.
John, your audio volume is just right. You sound good. Thank you. Good information. So it looks like there's a lot more pirates than I thought. Oh, amazing. And so, sounds like it's a little bit of a revolving door, Eric, from what you described. They get accused, convicted, and then just moved to another location with another set of call letters, maybe, and maybe a new set of equipment. Does their equipment get confiscated when they get, what's the word for it now? Attacked, if you know what I mean. Sounds to me like when they get caught, that's the word I'm looking for. When they get caught, if they confiscate their equipment, that would slow them down a little bit. But if the equipment is not being confiscated, it must be awful easy for them to open up again somewhere else. KE2EJ, KQIW.
K2IWK2J. It's funny you should mention Prometheus because I'm part of the engineering staff. I've put together, we do this thing called barn raising where a community will apply for a low power license. Actually, Prometheus sued the FCC a number of years ago and actually won, and they made low power possible. You gotta remember there's different kinds of pirates. There's the guys at the college that do wire out window, where they're doing carrier kinds, stuff like that. You know, a little 5-watt transmitter. It's, you know, if you go by the rules, you can't have more than 60 dBU 1,000 feet away or something like that. I don't remember exactly what it is. But, the big guys, they get their gears taken from the transmitter site, but not from their office area or their where their studios are, and they move them around. The FCC takes their gear. If it's, you know, somebody's stupid enough to have it all in one place, they take everything. It lacks a real guide, and they give them the slap on the wrist and, you know, a tiny little fine as opposed to the repeat offenders who put out the big guns and the big power and the big antennas. They get caught. But the amount of money that they're making, it's pretty easy for them to do it all over again.
I can see how the FCC tries to eliminate pirates for fear that it could develop into something outrageous. But if the pirate has a low-power station covering a local area of people of a particular community that speak a particular language, to a small degree, it's almost a victimless crime in my mind. I might be wrong. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, as far as Mr. Pye is concerned, you're doing something illegal. And if you don't comply with Part 15, they become a pain in your ear.
At what time, I think the requirement for AM broadcast station carrier current on, say, for instance, the campus of a college, as long as you can keep all of the signal going beyond the perimeter of the college, below something like 15 microvolts per meter, then within the land of the college itself, you can set up a carrier current station, and I don't even think it requires a license. Over to you, Eric, on that one, K2LAW.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, carrier current is FM, AM, sorry, and that doesn't happen too often anymore. Everybody's into doing FM. They want the fidelity, so. I mean, if you look through the people that have been fined and caught, you got little guys in the Bronx and in Queens, and, you know, they're trying to cover a little area of their station, and they get whacked. And the reason why they get whacked is because somebody complains.
Is a pirate successful in finding a so-called white channel or an empty space where he can locate his repeater, his pirate station, which therefore doesn't interfere with any other local commercial station? Are they sometimes able to do that, Eric?
Well, if you go away from the metropolitan area, New York, yeah, you can do that. I mean, the waiting list for low-power stations. Now, low-power stations will be in the gray zone between two full-power stations, and even the full-power stations will complain, and that's one of the things that the FCC got sued about. The way the laws are written now, you can be licensed to operate a low-power station within your geographic area, and it really covers about 10 miles, and that's it. You know, a lot of different circumstances, but, I'll tell you a funny story. We had built a 100 milliwatt exciter, and my friend, who's not with us anymore because he went down with the World Trade Center, we put it up on the shelf. We were playing Dark Side of the Moon, you know, a CD on auto repeat. We were just letting it burn, and it was into a load. And one day, one of the guys from the FCC comes upstairs and is asked, you know, they're having trouble finding where the station was coming from. And Rod walks into the back and goes and shuts it off.
So even though it was going into a dummy load, the leakage from such an extremely good site was making it hearable some number of miles away from the building. Is that true, Eric?
It's quite a few number of miles. You know what it was? It was on the shelf. It was there for about a month. Everybody forgot about it.
Fun stuff. Okay. That's a fascinating industry you live in now. Broadcast, Eric. We're going to go on to Joe. W12Y.
Thank you.
Somebody's got a question? Go ahead.
I'm just saying thank you for your input.
Okay. Let's hope you are able to find a drone company that satisfies your requirements. That's the quickest way to find out really where you stand right now. And once you got the answer in the dB above a microvolt or a microvolt per meter, once you've got quantitative data as to how strong your signal is to the north, south, east, and west inside of that building, that's going to give you a lot of information as to what variables, what parameters you've got, what buttons you can press, so to speak, for changing the location of the antenna and making a guess as to what you might get. Guarantee the pattern you're going to get with that drone flight is going to be more complicated than anybody anticipated, because that's an awful big structure you're in. Alrighty, Joe, to B2RYY. K2RIW, you got it, Joe.
Chair, one quick comment.
Go right ahead, John.
Just wanted to finalize my thoughts that I got my information in order. N3KOW, that's Nancy 3 kilowatt Oscar, West, and check out the Prometheus radio project if this kind of information excites you. KC2SHO. Thanks.
Actually, in the basement of a church.
So I think you said November 3 Kilo Oscar Whiskey. Sounds like you have actually had some communication with him, Eric, also. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, I'm in touch with all the people. Actually, one of my friends that used to work for Channel 13 is on the board of Prometheus.
So it's quite a club among people in the broadcast industry. You haven't had a chance to go to the Computer Electronics Show for some time, have you, Eric? I bet you missed that.
No, National Association of Broadcasters, the NAB show, it's on now. It starts tomorrow.
Is that held out west this year?
To Vegas. I had been to the last, up until a few years ago when the station cut back, I had been to 30 of them.
Wow. Roughly how many exhibitors and roughly how many attendees at the NAB show, Eric? Go ahead.
It varies between 40 and I think the biggest one was like 96,000 or something like that.
96,000 visitors and how many vendors?
No, off the top of my head, probably maybe 400 or 500, if that many.
Now, this year, either the Computer Electronics Show, CES, I think it was, I can't think of what the word stands for, or the NAB, there must be a lot of displays this year what I'm trying to think, 3.0 ATSC equipment, 4K, ultra-high density receivers, transmitters, or whatever. My guess is that's a big item by Sony and, I can't think of the other name of a major company, but my guess is that's an awful lot of the display at NAB this year. Is that possibly true? Eric, go ahead.
This will probably be the fourth or fifth year of demonstration of advanced television. Actually, the camera and production manufacturers have been making 4K gear for a couple of years now. As far as transmitters go, it's the same transmitter companies, because the transmitter that transmits DSB will also transmit ATSC3, which is actually COFDM.
Does that mean that the transmitter you have, you can continue using, you just have to change the exciter in order to switch over to from ATSC 1.0 to 3.0? Is that roughly true, Eric? Go ahead.
Absolutely correct. In Europe, they transmit currently DVB-T, which is COFDM, and the transmitters are designed to operate either or a format, and it's just the exciter that's different.
Well, the modern-day ATSC 1.0 or 3.0, what's the approximate cost ratio? For
3.0 transmitter, Eric. Go ahead.
Well, the most expensive part is the transmitter. You've got to remember, they built transmitters that are designed to operate 100% duty cycle, 24 hours a day, for at least 20 years. So, you have the cooling system, you have the mechanical components of it, plus you have the output. Now, interestingly enough, I just fixed a 20-year-old transmitter, which uses BLF 861s in them, which are 32-volt transistors. They're actually LD MOS, which will produce about 150 watts a chip, and the whole thing blew up, so a kilowatt is 24 chips, because they run them conservatively, and actually they'll have a driver and two sets of these LD MOS chips that make it look like four sets. So, today, we use one LD MOS to make a kilowatt. So, it's different, you know. Also, you need reliable power supplies, monitoring, SNMD. Let me let it drop. And today, we no longer send ASI directly into the transmitter. We send IP, which has the ASI embedded in it. In the olden days of ATSB, or digital transmission, we would send something called SMPTE-310 into the transmitter. And that eventually gave way to ASI going straight into the transmitter. Now it's just a plain old Cat 5 Ethernet cable.
When you're doing the combining of a whole lot of individual transistors like you did in the past, and if you're doing it with the right kind of hybrid combiners with dummy loads built in, you have a characteristic that was called graceful degradation. Each individual transistor was isolated from all the others. So as you started losing transistors because of failures, the unbalanced power went into dummy loads, and you didn't have failures of the remaining transistors. There wasn't a cascaded failure. But I'm guessing that takes a little more cost to do it that way, and maybe when you said the whole thing blew up, does that mean you lost multiple final stage transistors? Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, well, this transmitter is actually originally designed for NMDS and IGFS, and they decided they liked the layout, and this was in 2001, I think. And this particular transmitter's got 16 boards in it. Each board has two sets of drivers. They go into a Wilkinson divider. There's a local load on each board, and on the Wilkinson, the combiner that actually puts the boards together in pairs, they got 100 ohm resistor across them, and those decided to take a leak too. And basically, I changed most of the RF generating stuff in it. And the reason why they all failed, and the interesting thing is none of the drivers failed. It got overdriven because the exciter decided it was going to put out way more energy than it needed to.
In theory, a Wilkinson power divider or power summer could give you complete isolation. However, of all the kinds of hybrids, Wilkinson is the one that has a very unusual load, 100 watt completely floating, 100 ohm completely floating resistor. And that's a difficult component to make at, let me pick a number, the 50 watt level. Therefore, I guess that component becomes vulnerable when you're using Wilkinson combiners as opposed to quadrature combiners. Is that true, Eric? KQIW?
Yeah, it is. Actually, my big transmitter that puts out 5 kilowatts or 10 kilowatts, that uses a mixture of Wilkinson and quadrature combiners. But there's still 100 ohm resistance between them. And there's a company called Florida RF that makes roughly 150 watts, 200 watts, beryllium oxide 50 and 100 ohm resistors. Actually, the load bank in the big transmitter can handle 300 watts per pair, and as long as they're well heat sink, they survive.
The real nice thing about an awful lot of the hybrids, particularly the quadrature hybrid, is that the 50 ohm load resistor can be easily completely shielded, grounded at one end, and then it's easy to make kilowatt load resistor if you wanted to, a 50 ohm
one terminal